First today, we hear Bill Resnick talking with Con Hallinan about Trump's foreign policy. Is there a pattern? Is he just an impulsive madman? Or are we looking at the throes of the wounded U.S. empire at the end of the American century? Bill?
Thank you, Fran. Con Hallinan, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Con Hallinan has taught journalism. He edited The People's World. He now writes for Foreign Policy and Focus, The Nation, many other journals. And a lot of his work is collected in his blog, Dispatches from the Edge. Con Hallinan, Trump seems to be pursuing a more, quote, muscular foreign policy. You courageously agreed to discuss the big picture of Trump and Trumpism in the world. Also to discuss how we can respond, that is, stop Trump and Trumpism, maybe produce a transformation of U.S. foreign policy. First, I think it would be good, though, to give some examples of what his administration is doing in these whirlwind of threatening and absurd things in this first, whatever it is, close to 3 months. How do you understand it?
Well, the problem with trying to understand Trump foreign policy is it kind of depends upon which day it is. So that, you know, one day he's saying, Assad is going to have to be part of the solution in Syria, and then the next day they're hitting airfields with cruise missiles and saying Assad has to go. So it's a very, use the term impulsive, it's a very reactive kind of foreign policy. When he came in, he sort of said he wanted to stay out of the Middle East. He was very hawkish on China. And sort of, you know, let's see if we can't get some sort of resolution with the Russians. Well, now that's all turned around. So now his Secretary of State Tillerson made a statement yesterday about the Russians that sounds like straight out of a Cold War. Apparently Trump had a pretty low-key, agreeable meeting with the Chinese, and, you know, that went well. And here we are cruise-missiling Syria. So to try and find a pattern in there is difficult, and I do think there was something in the lead-in to the program and which explains some of it, which is that the United States is at a point where it can no longer control all the events in the world. Even militarily, it can't do it. The last war that we won was Panama and Grenada. And so we're in this period of where there is a decline of the power of the Americans to influence world events and to sort of establish themselves. At the same time, we have this massive military force. We spend 50% of all of the military spending in the world. So it's a very unstable kind of period. On one hand, the United States is losing influence in the world, and at the same time, it's enormously powerful militarily. That can be a very dangerous kind of combination. I mean, the last thing you want is a country with enormous military power who's feeling insecure. You don't want that situation because it can be very volatile.
And especially with a leader who is so famously, notoriously, and crazily insecure, angry, and thin-skinned.
He's amazing.
The thing he does, it's like a child's garden of neurotic behaviors of a three-year-old.
Exactly. It's really, you know, he holds grudges forever. Everything is all focused on him. There's a lack of stability here. And that's why you say, what is Trump's foreign policy? It's sort of like, well, I don't know, because it's so impulsive. And my concern right now, I mean, if I were to, you know, point to the place that I think worries me the most right now, is the Western Pacific and East Asia, particularly the South China Sea. Because, you know, with the situation in Korea, and Trump gave an interview to the Financial Times a couple of days ago, in which he said, well, if China won't take care of Korea, we will. Now, what does that mean? Is the United States really seriously considering attacking North Korea? And how would they do that? And what would be the effect on the rest of Asia? With the exception of Japan, every country in Asia and Southeast Asia is utterly opposed to a military confrontation with North Korea because they have no idea where it would go. And in the case of Syria, in a sense, the attack on the Syrian airbase was a show. We destroyed a couple of MiG-21s. I didn't even realize MiG-21s should still fly. And, blew up some hangars and things like that. Didn't even blow up the airfield, for that matter. They've dropped the matter. I mean, that they've just gone back to the way things were. In the case of North Korea, I have no idea what the North Koreans would do. If there was an attack, I imagine that it would be an attack aimed at their nuclear weapons, at their missile complexes, etc. Most of these are very well hidden. How would the North Koreans react? Would they then turn on South Korea? And Seoul is within easy artillery distance of North Korea. City of, 2 million people or something like that? It would just be a mess. Plus, of course, if North Korea destabilizes and South Korea and the United States take over, then suddenly China is faced with a potentially hostile power on its border, and it's not going to allow that.
Let me add a few of the things to the Chinese and the South China Sea. You've written on this. Trump could blunder into war really, really easily.
Yes.
Khrushchev and Kennedy almost, in fact, exchanged nuclear weaponry, wars and over Cuba, and they were relatively rational people. Finally, they disengaged, made a deal. Actions that are taken that look like bravado or just gunboat diplomacy, people say, well, he's just staking out positions and frightening people and then forcing some kind of deal. But even if he were rational enough to think that way, all these actions have their own counteractions and more counteractions, which are going to expose him to humiliation unless he takes the next counteraction.
I agree with you. As you said, one of the things, psychologically about this guy is that he never likes to be bested, and he never likes to feel as if he's humiliated.
And he never forgets a loss.
No, that's fine if you're dealing with your next-door neighbor. You just kind of keep your distance from him. But if the guy has a nuclear weapon, that's suddenly a little bit different there. And certainly the Chinese at this point are very upset about a number of things. They're upset about the growing tension with North Korea. They're upset about the fact that the United States is putting an anti-missile system, the THAAD, into South Korea and Japan. And what they see is that they see that the United States is ringing China with some 400 potentially hostile bases. They're looking at this and they're seeing the 1950s and the containment strategy with the Soviet Union. And they don't like it. It also stimulates some of the aggressive sides on the Chinese side as well. And some of their actions, for instance, particularly in the South China Sea.
They also want to protect their sacred honor, right? I mean, in some ways, they stake out positions, and they're the representative of the great Chinese people.
There's a little bit of great nation chauvinism
right.
involved
there's
with
a huge,
the Chinese.
There's a horrible dynamics are occurring. That's also true, it seems to me. You point out that an attack on Iran would be so devastating and horrible that they aren't contemplating it. I don't think that's right. I think Netanyahu is playing the same role that Israel played in the attack on Iraq, sort of in the background, providing a lot of intellectual weaponry.
What it is that there's a lot of division on that. Now, the Saudis and the Gulf Cooperation Council people, in other words, all the Gulf monarchies, and certainly some of the Israelis would like to see an attack on Iran. On the other hand, the Russians have very close relations with Iran, and they also have pretty close relationships with Israel. And the Russians have been pretty steadily saying to the Israelis, don't contemplate attacking Iran. That's going to complicate things to an extent that is not in your interest. I'm not sure that the Israelis at this point want to attack Iran. I think what they want to do is they want to keep them as the sort of bugaboo in the region. And, of course, that's being done by Saudi Arabia and Turkey to a certain extent. And so what you have is these cross currents that are going on. And I've never seen this kind of complexity. I mean, just give you one short example in the Syrian civil war. You have Russia, Iran, Turkey, and Egypt pushing for a political settlement. At the same time, Turkey is attempting to do every single thing it can to undermine the Assad regime and is actually helping train this new army to fight the Russians and the Iranians. So these are just two completely bizarre cross currents that are going on at the same time. And to try and get some kind of logical, rational view of where this is going to go is really hard.
This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. We're trying to do something really hard to figure out what all this amounts to. And one thing that I think we can agree to, and that is certainly true, it's enormously dangerous what's happening. And this is not even to talk about his denial of climate change, and there are long-term huge threats, and then there are all these short-term huge threats like war with China, attacking Iran, creating this sort of clash of barbarisms in the Middle East, where a terrible struggle between the various forces there, with the U.S. supporting the Saudis of all people. It seems to me that there's this tremendous danger, and particularly when it's led by this madman. You know, some people talk, let for a second discuss this, that really the great controller or the moderator of Trump has to be the U.S. military, saying to him, no, this is militarily impossible, this could lead to so much worse, you really have to change your thing, and it ultimately having to, in fact, resist the Trumpism and turn against him, because he may want to use the military also at home, because there's going to be a lot of resistance at home. And his popularity ratings could fall enormously, which would destroy the poor guy, at least if he recognizes it. What do you make of that scenario now?
Well, you know, I know I've heard this. People have talked about this. I'm always uncomfortable with the idea of the military being our savior.
I know.
The common phrase in the military is, yes, sir. I think that the military, I mean, like, for instance, with this thing with Syria, the attack on the airfield in Syria, I think what happened was that he wanted to respond, and there was a bit of a payoff, and that was the military said, okay, look, we'll go take out this airfield, but you get Bannon off of the National Security
Council. Yeah, that does seem sort of...
And I think that's what he did. I think he... This is a guy, by the way, as you say, I mean, he really doesn't have any ideology except himself.
Well, he demands loyalty to himself, but he is absolutely disloyal to anything but his daughter and son-in-law, it appears.
Yeah, and who knows in the long run there either.
You know, family disputes sometimes escalate out of control, too.
I think that the idea that the CIA or the National Security Council, the military, et cetera, will act as a check, I'm always...
No, I agree. But in fact, at some point, if you look at the logic of things, that may be one of the only barriers to him. Bill Resnick here talking to Con Hallinan, who writes a lot, dispatches from the edge is his blog. You can read a whole lot of him just by Googling and finding the articles and very thoughtful articles and knowledgeable. Con, we have to talk about, I think that a real international response to Trump, bigger even than the response to the Iraq War, if you remember that, the international response was enormous, and it was enormous in the U.S. as well. Something on that line, but hugely bigger, it would have to be, I'm afraid. And moving also more positively towards a different foreign policy and international economic policy. We didn't even talk about the possible collapse of economies because of the uncertainty that he's causing for all. What can be done?
Well, I think in the short run, for one thing, I'm heartened by the fact that there has been so much response to what he's doing. I mean, here we in California, you know, we have a state sanctuary policy, not just city sanctuary policy. The whole state is a sanctuary. When the immigration order came through, absolutely spontaneously, through the internet, tens of thousands of people just besieged airports all over the country. And what I'm heartened by is that there has been a very sharp response, a real challenge to Trumpism. I think that is going to increase, if only because the fact that Trump continues to do one thing after another. The attempt to dismantle the medical care really caused a storm, in fact caused such a storm that they failed to do so. At the same time, of course, you know, he's now loaded the Supreme Court up, and I think this is going to be a long fight. I think it's got to be a very local fight, too. I think the Democratic Party has very much gotten away from what their natural base ought to be and has really not done the kind of work that the Republicans have done on the local level. And so you have this situation where I saw a thing in Illinois or something. The Republicans won 54% of the vote, and they won 77% of the congressional seats in the state. You know, that kind of gerrymandering has gone on, and it's gone on because the Democrats have just dropped the ball, and they have not done their job.
No, it has to be outside of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Grassroots Democrats, many of them are really good people, and we have to work with them. Con, you have about two sentences more. We're running out of time.
Well, I hate to quote Winston Churchill, but I think what you do with Trump is you fight him on the beaches, you fight him on the landing zones, you fight him in the fields, you fight him in the villages. We just don't give up.
And in the media and on KBOO Radio, Con Hallinan, thanks so much for talking to
us. Thanks for having me.
We'll do it again.
Okay.
So long.
Okay, bye.
Right.